Hello?
Hello?
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing? This is Patricia, how are you doing?
I'm good, this is Denise.
Denise, nice meeting you. I guess David is not there yet?
No, I think we're a few minutes early.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, I felt so bad, I was late the first class. For some reason, my registration didn't appear, so I had to contact the people there again, and I was really late. Yeah, so I missed.
Well, they record it.
Yeah, I listened to it. It seems like a lot of information. I'm hoping that today we slow down a little bit and we get more into details, or maybe the fact that I wasn't there, it just seems like a lot of information at once. I don't know. How did you think it went?
I think it went well. I like the fact that we're able to listen to the recording again. You know, because sometimes when it does go a little fast, you might miss something. So
yes,
it's good to be able to have access.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was nice. You're right. And we have also the, you send us the outline, so that'll help.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Florida. How about you?
I'm in New York.
Oh, wow. We're in the opposite extremes.
Yeah. Yeah.
How's the weather?
Very cold.
And I'm here wearing my shorts. I was just, I finished work early, so I was taking care of my sideways, and some of the trees have really made a mess, and I'm sweating. It's still so hot in here. It's like today it was in the 90s.
Really? What part of Florida?
I am in the Space Coast near Cocoa. I don't know if you're familiar with that area.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, near the Space Coast. So it's about an hour or so from Orlando, but we're in the coast.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely envy that weather right now because it's about 45 degrees in New York.
Oh, my gosh. Are you in New York City?
I'm in Long Island, which is about 45 minutes from the city.
Right. How do you like living there?
Well, I've lived in New York pretty much all my life, and I prefer the island over the city, that's for sure.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, they're a pretty exciting place to be. I live in a small town, so, so anyway, but I like New York. It's very nice to visit. So many things to do.
Right. Well, we can trade. You can come over here and I'll go over there.
Okay. Well, you're
welcome
to come.
Okay.
We'll do that.
Sorry if I'm interrupting.
Hello, Dave.
How are you guys?
Hello. It's the beautiful weather that they're having in Florida.
Oh,
yes. It's in the 90s. Hi. This is Patricia. Who is this?
Oh, hi. This is Belinda.
Hi, Belinda. Nice meeting you.
Hey, welcome, everybody.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Carrie.
Hey, well, thanks for signing on early and interacting. There are a couple of questions that I had sent that I want to respond to, and then if there are any other questions, or let me take any other questions or comments or clarifications from our first seminar first, and then there are a couple of responses that I had sent to me, and feel free to do that, to email me any questions or request by email. So anything you want to add or ask to begin? As I mentioned, I'll always preserve a bit of time at the beginning and the end for discussion. The simplest question was, would you briefly review the most effective way of recommending professional services to a client or organization? And remember, I suggested, can I get a management of background noise? There's whatever you're doing, any kind of movement or paper shuffling is picked up by your microphone. So do a mute, *6, and then when you're ready to talk, do a *6 again. I'll put us on lecture mode for the presentation part so you don't have to worry about that, but I want to keep an open mic for any responses. remember I suggest to use the model of any professional you choose, a doc, a dentist, a CPA, and to apply the three components of story. You go into a professional, there's a brief discussion about what kind of things that you'd like to focus on or problems or issues. The professional makes a recommendation. And the recommendation can be in three components, not more than one sentence each. The challenge, what it is that the specific person wants to do or needs to get done, or why they sought consultation to start with. What you would recommend specifically about how to do that, and then the resolution of the specifics of what you suggest in terms of setting up a, if it's a weekly standing time, fill out a client information packet, do an online payment for the monthly retainer that covers all the appointments plus materials and resources. So those three story components to summarize the client's challenge, how you can help, and then your recommendation of mentor coaching and the framework and the fee, if that's what the application here, the person who sent the question is a mentor coach. So I hope that makes sense and clarifies, because I think this is an important component, because this is often a difficult challenge, especially for people who are making a transition into coaching from other careers and other things. A couple of you have asked for more examples or a brief case study of the principles of influence. And I found one that I'm going to adumbrate some of the principles of persuasion, the neuroscience of persuasion that we're going to talk about in this seminar, and also some tools for neuromarketing. So there's going to be a foreshadowing of some things we're going to talk about. It's one of the best applications I could find that combines all of these. So see how many of the elements we've discussed you can identify. Jot them down as you hear them, and I'll review them at the end, because some we haven't discussed and will in just a bit. Tom Sawyer is whitewashing a fence under strict orders from Aunt Polly. A neighborhood guy named Ben walks by, teasing Tom of his afternoon plans. Ben said, "Say, I'm going swimming. Don't you wish you could? But of course, you'd rather work, wouldn't you? Of course you would." Tom contemplated and said, "What do you call work?" "Why, ain't that work?" Tom resumed his whitewashing, answered carelessly, "Well, maybe it is, maybe it ain't. All I know, it suits Tom Sawyer." "Oh, come on now, you don't mean to let on that you like it?" The brush continued to move. "Like it? Well, I don't see why I oughtn't to like it. Does a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day?" That put the thing in a new light. Ben stopped nibbling his apple. Tom swept his brush daintily back and forth and stepped back to notice the effect. A touch here and there, criticized the effect again, Ben watching every move and getting more and more interested, more and more absorbed. Presently, he said, "Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little." Tom considered, was about to consent, but he altered his mind. No, I reckon it wouldn't hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence. Right here on the street, you know. But if it was the back fence, I wouldn't mind and she wouldn't. Yeah, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done real careful. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that could do it that way, and it's got to get done." Well, you know what happens next. Ben is ignited, setting off a contagion of desire that ends with Tom happily observing as the neighborhood kids barter and beg for the chance to whitewash the fence in his stead. Tom incorporates some essential elements of influence and persuasion. These are some that we're about to discuss. Liking. Obviously, Tom is a likable guy. Most obvious that he likes himself. Scarcity. He moves from liking, relatedness, and connection quickly to scarcity, emphasizing his autonomy and certainty. He demonstrates his mindset of enjoyment. He speaks and acts committed and consistent. He embodies reciprocity, and again, we're going to talk about each of these, from his position of authority. The contagion of social proof frames the conversation. And Tom is definitely an expert of managing the state of others. That's all of Seminar 3 that we'll be discussing. Beginning with himself, then Ben, then the Legion of Whitewashers. So each now belongs to a new, highly motivated group to engage in a meaningful endeavor. And remember, we talked about people don't buy products, they buy states. They buy for emotional reasons and justified by logic. It does not happen in reverse order, and it wouldn't have worked for Tom in reverse order. So that's the best case illustration that I could find. Any thoughts or questions or comments about anything we've discussed before we move into our topic for this evening? Okay. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion. Here's a persuasion quiz, and this one is in the correct place, as opposed to the one beginning last time. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted in life various pleasurable activities. Receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, eating a favorite food. And a hint is one of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. Persuasion can be defined as an active process of choice architecture to get a prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your product or service. The most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate is this: it's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question: what is it you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and established his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. He presented his client's side in detail. Then people listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest in speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. So, let's look now at persuasion neuroscience, and particularly at the twin forces of pleasure and pain, the two most fundamental motivating forces that we have as human beings, and how to apply them. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. We have twice as much pain at losing $100 than we do pleasure at gaining $100. If you have time, review my archived blog, and it's especially applicable now, The Allure of Chaos. It elaborates a little bit more what we're talking about. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. The brain registers twice as much pain from losing $100 than pleasure from gaining $100, a loss aversion. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. From psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior. Desire to avoid pain, desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of how our brains are wired to minimize danger or pain, to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. Meaning, if someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone does not buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. So here's a master formula for persuasion. To associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. Greater gain with action, loss with failure to act. Some people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. Both avoiding pain and inertia, remaining in the status quo, are two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short term equals pain, giving up their money, for example. Most people need to think long term to be successful because the gains aren't always immediate. Think about, for example, how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills. Doing taxes. Today is the deadline for the last extenders. Exercising. Maintaining your house and car. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than innately designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. That's why it takes more planning. So let's apply this pain, pleasure, brain formula to the three-story components. The challenge. Find the need or interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but are not getting. The development. Show how to meet the challenge. The resolution. Clarify both the emotional and the logical reasons to act. The benefits. People want emotionally but justify logically. So, find emotional motivators. To have or be the best for their clients. To have the best relationship or skill set. To be fully informed. To be confident. Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on price, this adds to their pain rather than alleviating it. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up, and that includes our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket and then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Way less than half of the participants agreed, even when bribed by chocolate. So they got another equal chance of winning plus some chocolate, but most of them didn't want to do that. When the experiment was repeated with pens instead of lottery tickets, 90% of the participants agreed to trade. Pens are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope, dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid the regret they would experience if it switched and their original ticket won. So it took a higher price just to change out for an equal chance. So, what this means in a different way, from a marketing perspective, giving someone $100 to be applied toward a future purchase is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one of these five or more of these five things. Reduce the fear of making a mistake. That's how some people add, you know, money back guarantee. Make them feel more in control, to focus on the benefits of what they're going to get, the mastery. Simplify the decision process. Make it simple, one click, one step. Offer simple, clear, immediate emotional benefits and eliminate any obstacles. So, here are six principles of persuasion, and these are compiled from research that began in the middle 80s and extends to present day. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain, strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes have a high likelihood of failure. Information does not lead people to make decisions. Remember, I mentioned last time, if information would change behavior, we'd all be thin, work out every day, eat mostly vegetables, have a lot of money saved, and a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. But the mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How we communicate information can dramatically affect both how it's perceived and how it's acted on. So these are six principles of persuasion. The first, liking. Remember Tom Sawyer. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. So the application, find something in common. Discover real similarities, genuine connection. Offer authentic comments. Here's another case illustration. When I was 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town of 600 people where I lived on a farm. We looked at coats at three stores because that's all there were, Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask, because that was the option. And at one store, though, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at was a light blue, soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. Pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like the coat, but I sure did like that salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I couldn't grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice sales guy while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So, here's an application I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. And here's how I got that name. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school, and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game with me, and we'd have dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. Notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially how he relates to everybody on the court. After the game, I asked each what they noticed and to not tell the other, who was still at home, the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team players. What else, I asked? And the referees. Anything else, I nudged. They each mentioned some aspect of how much he actually fouled and that he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides and the referees especially liked him. And he genuinely seemed to like them. We were courtside. We were kind of eye level, so they got a good feel for this. And they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated. The other team, his teammates, the referees, they all participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel they participated in that success if they had to call a foul and disrupt the flow of the state of good energy experience with him. In his entire NBA career, Magic only fouled out of 5 games. That's a record. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. And think about how referrals come through relationships. What are the factors that cause one person to like another person? They're not all visible. Here are 4 of the most common. The halo effect. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. And we're always teaching people how to respond to us. A second, similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. It activates that identity part of our brain. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at my mastermind group and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we had personally in common in my introduction of him. Not planned, necessarily. A third, compliments. Joe Girard, called the greatest car salesman in the world, said that the secret of his success was really liking clients. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message. And his message always included, "I like you." And people who knew him said he authentically meant that. And a fourth, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds and more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried this statement in his wallet with him at all times. Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story. We are wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained 1 of 4 possible photos: smiling baby, cute puppy, happy family, elderly couple. And another group of wallets had no photo at all. The percent of wallets that were returned: with the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With an elderly couple, 28%. With no photo, just under 14%. The second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help people, they will want to help us. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. The application, give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively or collaboratively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Of course, it's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed a number of other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who received a Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in buying over twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the Coke. Think about the address labels you get as a gift with the request for a donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a gift piece of chocolate when they walked in the door. When reciprocity is meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive was impacted. And I fortunately knew about this study at least in time for my two stepdaughters when they were in college and had jobs, so I could help them. To diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased almost 4%. To diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14%. In another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away and unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. The element of novelty which induces dopamine. A different topic and area, but it's applicable here. A third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others, especially in ambiguous situations when we're uncertain. We do things we see other people doing, even more so if those people seem similar to us. The application here provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct or popular or acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. And again, especially in situations that are different or uncertain. In a study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. Then at another matched time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so that the approaching subject would see it. Viewing this act increased donation 8 times. And in follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by seeing the other person donate on their actions, or donate money and change their actions accordingly. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music. So, what this means is that basing influence strategies on what people acknowledge that influences them can have a high failure rate. People are usually not conscious aware of what influences them or what to attribute as the cause. Add specificity. A study in Great Britain found that the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option that indicated the specific number of their fellow citizens living in their zip code who were doing it. And that involves the pain of giving up money. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and that are desirable and that are visible. Social proof and other influence factors have to be both authentic and ethical. We're not talking about manipulation here. We're talking about transparency and understanding how the mind and the brain work. So authentic and ethical are fundamental. A fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made. Think about, those of you who are mentor coaches, think about how you end a coaching session with a client to ask them, based on what we've talked about, what would you commit to do in this next week that would give you some traction in this area? Especially the commitments that are made public to others. The application, write down and publicly declare a commitment. We're then more likely to follow through or to get your prospect or your client to do that. Now, here's a question I'll bet you've already considered. What can persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? How many of you have had no-shows the first time or given a sample session, there's a no-show? Well, there are some studies. You might have guessed. A series of experiments were conducted at three busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time in a standard appointment-making call, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through. But here's a variation that had an even greater effect. Usually, the receptionist gives the patient at the time of leaving an appointment card, writes the date, and writes the time, hands it to the patient. Now, the variation here was the receptionist asked the patient to write the time and date the next appointment on the card. The result, an 18% reduction in no-shows. What that does is to put it in an output channel in the mind and brain. This creates a complete cycle. When something is in an output channel, it enhances both memory, retention, and the tendency to act. We touched on that last time. The best chance a commitment will be fulfilled is when there's ownership of it. And putting it in an output channel puts it in a position of ownership. There's less commitment when somebody else writes out the plan, when somebody else tells you what to do. We learn and remember best what we put in an output channel, writing notes, or talking about what we'll engage. In instances where it's not workable or reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it's more productive to get a response, such as an email, to simply check yes to confirm an agreement. This enhances commitment rates, or if you've had a negotiation and have something, a letter of understanding. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories and to use an output channel in the process. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We make it make sense to us. We gather the data to confirm it. We have a tendency to want a confirmation bias and selectively omit data that refute it, an inattentional blindness. These are all biases. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that will justify and actually fulfill our earlier decision. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. Both mind and brain incline toward continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. Now, think about how marketers use this principle. Continuity programs utilize this characteristic. You give your credit card number to sign up for three months of a subscription. You're charged beginning the fourth month unless you unsubscribe. In other words, it takes moving from the status quo to initiate unsubscribing. 82% of people don't initiate unsubscribing. 62% of those remaining subscriptions are not read, but they still haven't unsubscribed. So automatic consistency and maintenance of the status quo functions as a shield against further thought and deliberation. So a principle here is to make it easy to continue with a process, not that you want to dupe someone, but make it easy when it's possible to continue so that and a natural way to do this is for example, in coaching is a monthly retainer where someone fills out information, is charged before your first appointment, and then it recurs each month, same date after that, and you don't have to do an invoice, you don't have to, you know, have the client make a new decision every month. They just unsubscribe when you are done. So make a single good decision to set up, for example, an automatic amount of money from your checking to your retirement account first day of each month, another application, a different time to discuss this. So here's the fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is an application of the halo effect. The application, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. When you need someone to advance your case, product, or service, having an agent or an advocate can be really helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements or testimonials from respected authorities. And here's an application also. When you negotiate with an organization, first develop an internal champion within that organization who advocates and provides information. A valuable source of information and internal advocacy can give you all kind of information. A sixth principle of persuasion is scarcity. Now, I know each of you are familiar with this. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Objects and opportunities seem more valuable when their availability becomes limited. The application here, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton said it very simply. The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Now here's an illustration. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided that she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit. But Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Both of them were at the throes of loss aversion. They would not give up that bear. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears. Even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate, inspired desire. As all children do, they both had a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it seems to become more valuable and enhances desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number, only 2 left, 1 day remaining. We're not making any more of this. Mimetic desire, that is, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. We need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what would be lost if someone does not act or purchase. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react by trying to possess that even more than before. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume that it's more worthwhile when it's limited. Louis Neiser captured this, I think, brilliantly. He said, "Some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them." Many years ago, after I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people, the average 4 to 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or just no registration. Remember, this is in the evenings. The first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. I was an optimist. I didn't know consciously at that time about the scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. So here's a brief overview of these 6 universal principles of persuasion that apply to mind and brain sciences. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive associations. Shared similarity, being together and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates the hormone of connection, oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. That's one of our basic 6 human needs, is certainty. Consistency and scarcity both motivate action. Number 2, autonomy. Having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of significance, to feel important, unique, and effective. When you understand what people need and believe, you can show them your product or service and how that will help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. And the third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can, let me back up. I skipped over the first of the 4 primary tools of persuasion. The first is relatedness and connection. And this is almost intuitive. For a long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that sense of caring and connection. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, and ways of constructing meaning, that person's subjective reality. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but also to communicate that understanding. This is always the first step, to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. Remember, it's what we illustrated in the first seminar about getting inside the circle. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand, and they'll correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust each other, the greater the collaboration and shared information. So here's the answer to the persuasion quiz at the beginning, the Ohio State University, the option that is the generator of self-esteem. The other 4 are markers. The students valued most boost to their own self-esteem, so such as receiving good grades or compliments more than the other four combined. Now, the second tool of persuasion, as I mentioned, autonomy, the sense of having control over our environment, the choices we make. So we need to understand what people need and believe, and that we can show them how your product or service will help them to be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery, and thereby their autonomy of effectiveness. The third tool is certainty. To be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is that basic human need. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns, how we listen to the same music, go back to the places we've been, order the same food. There's a kind of pleasure in predictability. At least we know some things are predictable. We can even move to the default mode and it takes less energy. Change always generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism and contributes to a resistance of change. So, we can increase certainty by making concepts tangible. That includes how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives, the particulars of your service or product. Much of the field of management, for example, addresses increasing a sense of certainty at a time of change and transition. And think about the percent. Those of you who are mentor coaches, think about the percent of your clients who are going through some aspects of both change and transition, and that would be 100%. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty and is contagious. So, these three primary tools of persuasion are three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. And that's an application of basic human needs to the experience of any kind of marketing, any kind of endeavors that you engage in. Now, I want to just look at the summary of what we've talked about. Here's a very simple principle. It's called the 10-10 principle. A buddy of mine, Mark Wallman, who wrote a book that I think is really useful called How Words Can Change Your Brain. He's done research on the 10-10 principle. Hold both fists in front of you. Raise one digit each time you speak a word. When you run out of fingers, you stop speaking. And this will quickly train your brain to use 10 words in order to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity. This is hugely persuasive. His research showed that in charged situations, such as divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, it resolved 20 to 25% of the usual time that it takes and reached much more satisfying and complete conclusion. So keep this in mind in conversations. Clarity, brevity, simplicity. Because the temptation is to use too many words to explain questions, to give multiple choices. Other considerations to heighten and impact retention. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what problem or challenge you address, then the benefits that you bring. Listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. Reduce noise. Include only what is simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. An example here, again, is if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct. Then pause. Don't elaborate, explain, or stack on another question. And have fun. States of mind are contagious. My favorite grandmother, each of you have heard me say this multiple times, said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So we're in conversation mode now. Any thoughts or questions or clarifications about what we've talked about? Does this application of persuasion principles make good sense to you? The fourth
rule
of persuasion, I didn't elaborate because we're going to talk all of next seminar on that, and that's state management, to manage emotions and states of mind, and how important focus is. One of the most important and powerful ways we regulate states of mind, and we determine someone else's focus by the questions we ask. So asking questions is the most powerful tool to persuade someone, and the way we ask the question frames the answer. We'll talk about this all of next seminar, because a common mistake that we make, me included, is to try to point out all the available information and the rationale for why people should pay attention to it. And these four principles of good writing, good speaking, clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity also apply to the art and science of explanation. So we want to look at the challenge, elaborate on that, and then provide a resolution. Questions or thoughts?
Hi.
Hey, welcome. Go ahead.
Okay. This is Belinda. And,
welcome.
Hi. Well, I liked when you were talking about reciprocity. And I noticed that the way that I process the information is more like thinking of examples where I have experienced that more than how can I apply that right away.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking about two companies out here that, so Olive Garden, right? The Olive Garden restaurant chain, they always have those little after-dinner chocolate mints, those little square ones that everybody likes, like Arctic mints.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were talking about that the tips go up 14% when they give two chocolates. Well, they've never given me one chocolate. It seems like their policy is to just somebody there knows this, because their policy is that they bring the check and they have two of those little chocolate mints right on there.
That more recent study about giving one, turning away, and coming back, they're not onto that yet, but they will. And
okay.
I want to highlight what you're saying by saying each of you use that as an example to think about the kinds of things that have persuaded you, what you've responded to, what's worked and what's
mm-hmm.
not worked. That's huge. Everything I've talked about is simply studying that, but your intuitive response is going to give you some valuable information about what works and what works for you, because that's going to be more authentic for you. Now, I interrupted you. Go ahead, because I like what you're saying. You're highlighting something really important.
Well, there's also a wonderful chocolate company out here. It's Native American people. They have this wonderful.
I assume you're calling from California when you say out here.
I'm in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, okay.
I'm a New Yorker who lives in Oklahoma.
Okay,
so
you're about as far west as you're going to go. Okay, I got it. Go ahead.
That's right. Well, the company's name is Bedray, and they have a wonderful facility right off I-35 interstate, right? And on the highway, they have their promotional ads, you know, on the highway. But on the bottom, in a little banner, it says free chocolate. So when you go in there, the first thing they do is they have someone greet you at the door with a piece of their homemade, like they have chocolate-covered potato chips or something like that. And I have never left there with my hands empty. I've always purchased something.
Some of these principles of influence and persuasion are sort of intuitive, but yet when they're really studied, it can help us look at what will determine responses and what can benefit, what can help a client benefit in ways that we know they're going to benefit if they purchase a product or service, but yet they don't know it, and the immediate decision is parting with money because that activates the pain center in the brain and not the pleasure center. So it has to be framed in a way to be able to collaborate with someone to help them see the benefits and decide to make a decision. It's kind of like, you know, saving for the future. It's an abstract notion. It's something way off in the future. There's the more immediate benefit of time. Can I get a management of background noise? Your microphone is picking up a lot of noise. And the immediate pleasure of buying something is a hit of dopamine. Still some noise. Can I get a mute, please? Thank you for adding that, Linda. I appreciate it.
It really fit in with commitment and consistency, just as you're saying. Once I tasted the chocolate, I realized that there was a very the quality, and of course I was willing to buy. So that kind of fit in with number four also. I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Anything else? We've got just a couple of minutes. Any other thoughts, questions, comments?
This is Patricia, and I just wanted to, I have a challenge, and one of the things that I try to do to persuade my future clients is give them a free session, and it seems to be working very well. They're very excited. However, when it comes to talking about the painful part, which is the paying the money, then it's just a completely drawback, and this is a challenge for me, and I'm wondering if it's something that I'm doing wrong or if I'm not being persuasive enough to make them feel that they need more, or what is happening.
Well, there is a study that's a quiz at the beginning of a future seminar that the primary determinant of someone's science. Here's the quiz. Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to determine what would cause someone to sign on for their services or what would cause someone to decline. Same reason both ways. Same reason that caused somebody to sign up or to decline. So here are the options. Years of experience, expertise as in credentials and letters behind your name, state of the economy, amount of the fee, or reputation. So what do you think it was? Just because of time, I'm going to...
Reputation.
The answer is none of the above. It was the clarity and the confidence with which someone stated the recommendation and the fee. That's why I emphasized the three-story components of making a professional recommendation. Think about the kinds of recommendations any other professional makes, and they engage those three-story components, make a recommendation, and then the person, the client, the patient, whatever decides whether to do that. So if you're picking the right people, that's the first thing. Are you picking the right people to do sample sessions with? Are you providing a true model of how it would be to work together in coaching, selecting a specific agenda item, looking at their success map of where they want to get to, doing it within the time frame, and then making the recommendation I think you'll have a higher and higher success rate. Your conversion rate of ordinary citizens into paying clients will get better and better.
Okay, yeah.
So that's the beginning of an answer. We'll come back to that. Thank you all very much. If there are any questions or comments, don't hesitate to send me an email, and we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.